Okay, welcome everybody to our next installment of the Sufi Studies Network. Welcome all. It's great to be with you. It's great to see you all. And I'd like to welcome today our special guest, our speaker, Mohammad Mirzai. And I'll just say a little bit of introduction about Mohammad, and then I will quickly pass it on over to Mohammad to deliver to us his speech for today, his lecture for today. It's a pleasure to introduce Mohammad. He is currently a PhD candidate of religious studies in the Graduate Department of Religion at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, USA. He will be Dr. Mirzai very soon in the next few months. Congratulations. concurrently, Mohammad is a lecturer of religious studies at Middle Tennessee State University in Tennessee. He is the recipient of prestigious fellowships from the Robert Penn Warren Center for Humanities and Center for Teaching at Vanderbilt University. A dexterous translator from English to Persian, he has introduced substantial monographs of classical Orientalists, such as Marianne Mollet, and contemporary scholars such as Kevin Van Bladel to Persian readers. Having earned degrees in Persian literature, as well as old Persian languages and cultures, Mohammad is also immersed in method and theory in the study of religion. Today's lecture, titled Knowledge is Power, Politics of Mystical Knowledge in the Illuminationist Philosophy of Yahya Suhrawardi, died in 1191, focuses on the intersection of Islamic philosophy, Sufism, and pre-Islamic Persian philosophies, and criticizes the modern reception of such crisscrossing. I am super excited about this speech and looking forward to hearing from our dear guest, Mohammad. Welcome. Thank you. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Milad, for the very generous, kind, and gracious introduction. Thanks a lot. Let me share my screen and start timing myself. So let me begin with an episode from the life of Suhrawardi, cited by Ibn Khaldun's Wafiyat al-A'yan, or The Passings of the Noteworthy. There he says, Shaykh Saif al-Din al-Amidi said, I met Suhrawardi in Aleppo. There he told me, beyond any doubt, I will come to control of the earth. I asked him, whence has this thought stricken you? He said, I saw in my dream as though I drank the water of the sea. I said, could this refer to fame for knowledge or matters of that rank? But I saw that he would not recede from what had occurred him in the soul. I saw him a person of abundant knowledge and meager reason. So this is about, this is a talk about Shihab al-Din Yahya ibn Habash al-Suhrawardi, the outstanding philosopher and mystic in Islamic philosophy, and somehow received to be part of the tradition of Sufism, although that is a very contested idea. We'll not focus on that today. He was born and raised, he was born in Suhraward near today's Zanjan in Western Iran, and made himself present to many teachers. And then he, with whom he studied philosophy, theology, and also sciences and medicine. And then he joined the circle of Malik al-Lahir, son of Salahuddin al-Ayyubi, in Aleppo. And eventually he was murdered by starvation by the order of Salahuddin, accused of heresy, specifically refuting the Sharia and teaching the possibility of prophethood after Muhammad. In the 20th century study of Islamic mysticism, Yahya Suhrawardi has received a special attention as a prodigy of philosophy and mysticism, who brought together philosophy, Sufism, and the heritage of ancient Persian sages in the construction of a novel philosophical system. His life began in a common household in Suhraward, a village near today's Zanjan in Iran, and met an untimely end at the court of his once disciple, Al-Malik al-Dahir, the son of Salahuddin al-Ayyubi, in Aleppo. During his short span of life, he He mastered not only philosophy, theology, and jurisprudence, but also several strands of occult sciences, as his own writings and biographical accounts about him testify. According to the 20th century public image of the Shaykh, it was his mastery of mystical and philosophical knowledge that made him a thorn in the eyes of the formalist religious scholars encircling Salah ad-Din, the hero of Muslim response of the Muslim response to the Crusades, and the founder of the Ayyubid dynasty, and led to his torturous death at Salah ad-Din's order. Today, I'm going to discuss the politics of knowledge in his philosophical and mystical teachings. My main argument in this lecture is that in building his theory of knowledge, Suhrawardi was pursuing a particular way of translating mystical knowledge as the only authentic knowledge possible into a divinely authorized control over the world. This control is not only a matter of political qualifications, but one woven into the weft and warp of the entire hierarchy of creation. Suhrawardi's philosophy has been known as Hikmat al-Ishraq, or the philosophy of illumination. His way of founding his philosophy on two lines of heritage, a Western or Greek one and an Eastern, mainly Persian one, opened up his system to concepts related to light that he borrowed from the Zoroastrian heritage of ancient Iran. This construction of his philosophical system had a lofty share in the image made of the martyred Sheikh, as he was called in Persian texts, as a hero of Iranian national conscience, losing his life in a dedicated campaign for reviving the ancient mystical wisdom of Iranians. A look at his own writings, however, leaves no doubt that the value of ancient Persian sages' philosophy for him was only in its refined formulation of a philosophy in line with that of Plato, whom he calls the possessor of power and light, or Sahib al-Aid wa Nur, and had nothing to do with the Zoroastrian teachings, whom he calls the infidel among the Zoroastrians, or Kafaratul Majus, or the paganism of Mani, as he calls Manichaeism, which leads to attributing associates to God, transcendent and glorified, according to him. But if the Iranian and/or Zoroastrian character of these teachings was not the main point of the Khusravani, or kingly wisdom, as he called the Iranian heritage of philosophy, then why was it that he undertook the burden of merging them within his construction of philosophy? The summary of my answer to this question is that the main function of the Khusravani element, or ancient Persian element in Suhrawardi's philosophy, was political. But before delving into details of this suggestion, I will provide a brief overview of the available historical data about the Shaykh. Then I will compare this data to a reading of his works that will situate his use of pre-Islamic Iranian concepts on the broader map of his politics of knowledge, which in turn feeds directly into his political philosophy. The portrait that biographical sources render of Suhrawardi describes him as an immensely unruly person with exquisite intellectual capacities and a belligerent attitude toward religious scholars of the time. Due to Suhrawardi's controversial character and teachings, biographical accounts about him should be read with an eye as to how the possible hostility or predilection of the authors for these sources might have affected their reports. The two authors contemporaneous with the young Shaykh who provided us with some knowledge about him are both related to the Ayyubid court. One is one of the campaigners for his execution, Bahauddin ibn Shaddad, the biographer of Salah ad-Din al-Ayyubi, who accuses Suhrawardi of defying positive religions or shara'i'. The second one is the Shafi'i jurisprudent and historian, Imad ad-Din Katib al-Isfahani, a fellow affiliate of Salah ad-Din's court, who lived in Syria and probably Aleppo for a while, at the same time as the philosopher. According to him, the main point for which Suhrawardi's opponents found fault with him was his firm defense of the doctrine that it was still possible for God to send prophets after Muhammad. All the later narratives of Suhrawardi's life remained inevitably influenced by two elements. First, the hostility of the heroic figure Salah ad-Din towards Suhrawardi, and second, the sages on runic character that had become legendary in the urban culture of Aleppo decades after his death, as Ibn Khallikan had noted during his years of residence there. The complicated nature of Suhrawardi's image among the public is mirrored in the aforementioned trope of his knowledge outweighing his reason. According to these narratives, Suhrawardi leveraged a particularly mystical form of knowledge in two ways. First, in scholarly debates and writings, he appeared not only as a superior debater, but one who challenged the sufficiency of philosophy without the experience of a mystical union with the known as or the object of knowledge, as will be explained. Further than that, he has been mentioned as an overt practitioner of sleights of hand or simya and incantations or nairanj. The story of his arrival in Aleppo in the year 1183 of the Common Era, at the age of 29, having already written his comprehensive book on peripatetic philosophy, Al-Mashari' wal-Mutarahat, the Primers and the Exchanges 2 years earlier, might mirror this attitude. Arriving in Aleppo in a shabby outfit, the Shafi'i newcomer headed directly for Al-Jalawiyya Madrasa, where Iftikharuddin, the chief of Hanafi scholars of the town, and one of Al-Zahir's companions taught. There he made himself present to the class of Iftikharuddin in his humble cassock, participated in a debate on a jurisprudential issue, and overcame everyone present in the auditorium. This episode led to a series of events that very soon made him an object of Al-Zahir's curiosity and enticed the prince to come to the madrasa and ask the young scholar to join his court. When out in public, the unruly sheikh reportedly leveraged his knowledge even further, practicing occult sciences to work wonders in some of the most mundane situations. Masterful practice of sleights of hand and incantations to attract a following is an element found in almost all of his biographies. His unrestrained wonder workings were coupled with hazardous theological positions, such as advocating for the possibility of God sending prophets after Muhammad, drawing on the axiom of divine omnipotence, and further, that prophethood is acquirable. These positions granted him the place of a prophet among his companions, who, as recorded only by Shahr Zuri, his dedicated commentator, called him Father of Spiritual Favors, Messenger of God, or Abul Futuh Rasulullah. As a consequence of all these odd aspects of his teachings, not much later than the philosopher's death, Shahr Zuri records that the people would call him creator of creatures, or Khaliqul Baraya, due to the wonders that he would instantaneously make appear. While we get to look askance at such episodes, along with Suhrawardi's being equipped with what could be referred to as simia, both Suhrawardi and Shahr Zuri proactively defend the ability to create any object as a state which some brethren of abstraction, Ikhwan al-Tajrid, had reached, such as Bayazid Bastami and Hussein ibn Mansur al-Hallaj. Whatever the case was, eventually Shahr Zuri admits that a grave part of what led to his murder was Suhrawardi's provoking the ulama by demonstrating his superiority in theoretical knowledge, along with the wonders he would make appear with the power of the Holy Spirit. Others might have regarded these wonders or fictions about them as a saint's miracles or a charlatan's subterfuges. But for Suhrawardi himself, even if he did not do any of these himself, such interventions in the natural order of the world were not extraordinary phenomena, but the natural corollary of gaining true divine knowledge, a knowledge rooted in a sophisticated, complex ontology. His philosophical system was, as I will further explicate, intended to theorize this ontology in which knowledge and power beyond interdependence were identical or two names for the same elements of order throughout the hierarchy of existence. Convinced of such metaphysics of knowledge and power, Suhrawardi was aspiring to implement the Platonist model of utopian rule with a philosopher king at its top, a utopia backed by spiritual novelties worked into its most material aspects so that even money would be obliterated as a redundancy. One could speculate that His arrival in Aleppo in 579, 1183, did not simply happen to coincide with the year when Salah ad-Din had conquered the city and appointed his young son to its rule. The Sheikh's works strongly suggest that he saw this as an opportunity for getting nearer to the young ruler of the city and to educate himself in ways to educate him in ways that would realize his Platonist aspirations. Also, when in Aleppo, Suhrawardi wrote Al-Alwah Al-Imadiyya, or Tablets of Imad, for Imad ad-Din Abu Bakr, a ruler from the Harput branch of Al-Artuq, a household in a precarious relationship with the rising Ayyubids. As Shamsuddin Tabrizi had come to know, Imad ad-Din could be the ruler correspondence with whom became an alibi for the adversaries of Suhrawardi to charge him with hatching plots against the Ayyubids. Additionally, Suhrawardi's works read alongside biographical data, such as the one mentioned above that show him openly sharing his dream of coming to control of the earth, testify to possible ambitions beyond honing a young ruler into a philosopher king. While this dream has been narrated in multiple sources, the context in which the dream narrative was received is rarely noted. However, an odd record of Safiyyuddin al-Amidi's of Safiyyuddin al-Amidi, who was Ibn Khallakan's source for the dream, in As-Safadi's Al-Wafi bil-Wafiyat, which was written in early 8th century, can further, 14th century, can further contextualize this dream. He says, Al-Amidi came to Aleppo and met with Shahabuddin al-Suhrawardi, the murdered sage, and narrated from him that he said, Suhrawardi said, I saw as if I drank the sea, and this was a dream. Al-Amidi adds, and this was a dream that Ibn Tumart had had. This short account powerfully suggests that Suhrawardi's dream had unmistakable political connotations in Aleppo. Also, the brief reference to the dream and not going into details of how Suhrawardi interpreted it suggests that it was probably too well known to need reminders. Thus, it seems that Suhrawardi was known for presenting himself after the established model of Ibn Tumart, who lived between 1078 and 1081. Another scholarly figure, 1078 to 1130, well, the other way would be very short life. Another scholarly figure who had less than a century before departed from his scholarly position to found the Almohads, a dynasty that was at the time still sovereign over neighboring lands of the Maghrib and a veritable rival of the Ayyubids. Now, Suhrawardi's claim to a revival of the wisdom of ancient Persian sages was only a piece in his grander structure of a whole new philosophical system. This philosophical system, while based on the Greek heritage of Platonist philosophy, objected to peripatetic philosophers for not having realized the true content of the teachings of ancient philosophers. In his account of a mystical vision in which he had conversed with Aristotle, he cites the Greek philosopher to have rejected all the philosophers of Islam for not having reached even 1,000th of the degree of Plato. He says, I asked him, meaning Suhrawardi has asked Aristotle in that dream, did any of the philosophers of Islam attain his equal, that is, Plato's equal? No, he said, not even 1,000th of his degree. Thereafter, I set out to enumerate the ones whom I knew, and he did not attend to any one of them. Then I came to the names of Abu Yazid al-Bistami and Abu Muhammad Sahl ibn Abdullah al-Tustari and the people of that ilk. It was as if he was rejoicing, saying, truly are these the philosophers and the wise. They did not come to a standstill with formal knowledge, but reached further to knowledge by presence and attachment and intuition. To subvert peripatetic philosophy, Suhrawardi begins his reformulation of philosophy by replacing the model of knowledge based on conception or tasawwur and assent or tasdeeq with a direct experience of the known. This vision of the known is, just like his theory of physical vision suggests, a presence to the one source of being, that is the original light. This is the gist of his theory of knowledge, called knowledge by presence, or al-huzuri. In what seems to be an unacknowledged inspiration from Ghazali's Mishkatul Anwar, or the Niche of Lights, Suhrabardi borrows the term Nur al-Anwar, or Light of Lights, in reference to God as the source of all existence. Al-Ghazali's way of employing the concept of light in this book is different from the ways that many other Sufis would usually employ the same term. In his approach, light has three meanings. For the awam or layti, it means what is seen by itself and other things are seen by it. For khawas or the elite, light is indeed the eye or the seeing spirit that comprehends the light. But the most exalted meaning of light can also be explained with a qualified language. And I quote Ghazali here. He says, "Know that in the heart of humankind, there is an eye or wellspring," the Arabic word is ayn, "which is the quality of its perfection. It is the one now spoken of as intellect, now as spirit, and now as human soul. You, however, shall not mind the terminology, because when they abound, those who do not have sufficient insight would fall prey to the illusion that they refer to multiple meanings. Thereby, we mean the concept by which the intelligent, mature person is distinguished from the infant and the beast and the insane. Following public custom, we call it intellect, or aql, and say it deserves to be called light more than does the physical eye." End of quote from Ghazali. This definition of intellect as the highest of all three meanings of light leads to a conception of knowledge that can be seen as a source of inspiration for Suhrabardi in his formulation of knowledge by presence. For Al-Ghazali, intellect's knowledge of evident data is explained as the presence of those concepts to intellect. Knowledge of other issues also can be present to intellect only if intellect is awakened. Now, tackling the principles of peripatetic philosophy, Suhrabardi does not recognize an abstraction of wujud or existence as a more original element holding up an accidental manifestation of essence or mahiyya. In his view, such an abstraction is a misleading detour from the recognition of the world being formed by hierarchical emanations of the same element, the light of lights, or Nur al-Anwar, as the only existing element. Throughout a Plotinian system of vertical emanations, this light of lights creates lower emanations. The relation of the higher lights to the lower ones is one of dominance or qahr, and exchanged for love or mahabba from the lower ones for the higher ones. In this line of emanation, there is an element of dependence on a higher light that increasingly develops the dark side of materiality in being. The lower the lights are, the more dependent they are on the higher lights. In Suhrabardi's ontology, there are two ranks of lights. First, the dominant lights, then the ones with no link to the world of material body, and second, the managing lights. The dominant lights, in turn, break into two types, the superior dominant lights and the formal dominant lights. The latter lights, to which Suhrabardi sometimes refers using the Zoroastrian term for the archangels, that is, Amshas Pans, or the blissful immortal beings, are of a vertical order, and each gives birth to one of the celestial archetypes of species. Still, the formal dominant lights only give rise to these archetypes of material bodies and do not directly handle the material bodies. The material bodies are, in fact, born out of the absence of light. Each material body is a jauhar ghasiq, or dusky substance, that marks the edge of this absence and henceforth is called a barzakh or isthmus. The material bodies are managed by the second rank of lights, that is, the managing lights, or al-anwar al-mudabbira. Now, the first managing light that is positioned as the first mediator between the dominant lights and the spheres, is given the Arabicized title clearly borrowed from the Middle Persian bureaucratic vocabulary, the commanding light, or An-Nur al-Isfahbat. The Isfahbat, or commanding light, takes the place in illuminative philosophy that rational soul, or An-Nafs an-Natiqa, holds in peripatetic philosophy. This commanding light plays a more intricate role in Suhrawardi's arrangement of knowledge and power through its dual relation with ruling over the material world. On the one hand, and managing the perfection of cognitive and bodily faculties of human individuals on the other. In this dual role, the commanding light serves the same deputy function as did the Sasanian Ispahbads in the empire as viceroys to the King of Kings. The commanding light is the vicegerent, the viceroy of the light of lights. Its relation to the dark aspects of humanity, that is the body, happens through the subtle substance that is called the spirit. Spirit then is the relation through which the commanding light takes the human body as its fortress. That's the word that Suhrawardi uses. And makes, I quote Suhrawardi, the darkness in the fortress subservient to it, end of quote. All human faculties are in fact rays of the commanding light flowing within its fortress. The emanations of the light of lights reach down to the world of material bodies through a hierarchy of lights, each of which is existentially superior and dominant to the lower ones. The most supreme of the lights in charge of the material world is in fact vicegerent to the light of lights in the most administrative sense of the word, and its administration of material bodies, including human bodies, takes place through the relation that is spirit. Human bodies are only fortresses under the rule of spirit. If on the macrocosmic level, the rulership of the light of lights is mediated to the world of spheres and bodies through a vicegerent or the Isfahbad light, on the microcosmic level, the Isfahbad light has a parallel in the human constitution that forms the self or the personal individual subjectivity of every human being. In other words, as the individuation of spirit, every individual human subjectivity is an individual manifestation of the macrocosmic managing light. From this point to claiming that the individuals with the most knowledge of spirit are existentially the most qualified for exerting power, all that is missing is a bridge between inward and inward knowledge and outward power. The Shaykh completes this unification of power and knowledge through the connecting idea of Hurakhsh. Now, back to the grander macrocosmic scale, the prime embodiment of light in the world of ethereal bodies is manifested in the most noble creature of the material world, Hurakhsh, an entity that has not received in modern scholarship of Suhrawardi as much attention as its vigor is in his philosophy demands. Hurakhsh is one of the most significant figures in Suhrawardi's reception of ancient Iranian concepts. From the descriptions that Suhrawardi provides in a few places, we can safely infer that Hurakhsh, an evolved form of the Avestan word Huvarikh Shaita, literally meaning the sun or the radiating sun, is a slightly twisted form that he has opted to call the sun while lessening the risk of being attacked for worshiping the sun. Since the reign and power of the superior lights should be mediated to the heavenly spheres through stars, Hurakhsh, the most luminous of the ethereal bodies, is set as the chief of heaven, I quote Suhrawardi, revering whom is incumbent in the tradition of illumination, end of quote. Sitting at the top of the material world, Hurakhsh is the nodal point that brings together knowledge in its most mystical and inward sense and power in its most administrative and outward meaning. On the side of the mystical knowledge, Hurakhsh, as the mediator of all illumination to the material world, is the utmost authority for granting and validating spiritual knowledge attainable in the form of reading a written text or being addressed without seeing the source of voice. Also, sometimes the heavenly speaker can be seen in a heavenly image or in the image of one of the superior lords, as he calls them. Of these lords, the most superior manifestation is that of the great Lord Hurakhsh, the greatest of the august incarnated entities, the one who is the superior face of God. It would be the exalted aspiration, Suhrawardi says, of a wayfarer to move to his palace and not descend therefrom. On the outward side of power, Hurakhsh the Fierce is the theurgy of the formal dominant light, Shahrir or Shahrivar. Shahrivar is the Zoroastrian archangel or Amshaspand of rulership. Hurakhsh, the possessor of the most subtle ethereal body then, is at the same time the embodiment of the archangel of kingship and the upholder of and the witness to divine knowledge. Thus, it serves the unification of the hierarchies of knowledge and those are power as a principle. Human beings need a person to rectify their social lives, but this duty cannot be fulfilled just by anyone. In his Lamahat or the Flashing Gleams, Suhrawardi elaborates in a clearer fashion how the power of such a ruler should be backed by a knowledge deriving directly from the source of existence, and in turn, enabling him to exert power upon the material world. Here, he is more cautious to make the first sign, that is, being commissioned by God to being missioned by God to rectify the species, exclusive to prophets. However, the Shaykh is as clear in claiming that there are three more characteristics that are attainable for perfected mystics, or brethren of abstraction. I quote him, he says, "Second, being taught by the Holy Spirit without human training. Third, that the word of elements obey him without moving or sedating and other acts, so that he be like the soul or nafs to the word. Fourth, cautioning them about what is going to happen and informing them about particular happenings in the past or in the future." Elsewhere, he elaborates what he means by being like the soul for the word. I quote him. He says, "And know that the soul is God's vicegerent on the earth. As God, said, he is the one who made you vicegerents on the earth, raised some of you over others. The degrees are in accordance with the people's knowledge and the virtues of the souls and the ends of their orders." Another verse, "I am about to appoint a vicegerent on the earth." Another verse, "O David, we made you a vicegerent on the earth, and it would be abominable for God's vicegerent should his transitive kingdom cause his perpetual kingdom to perish. And this is more evident about the kings of the outer world, because it would be abominable if they were to be surpassed in the hereafter by those who were inferior to him, to them in this world. And it would be a grave loss if he is surpassed in the hereafter by those whom he had surpassed in the world." By way of conclusion, this last point could bring us to a point of completing the line of argument. Suhrawardi's philosophy of illumination is a way of negotiating philosophy with added elements of mysticism back to the realm of possible knowledge in post-Ghazali Islamdom, in a way that establishes mystical perfection as a divinely authorized right to domination over the material body. In this course, his use of ancient Iranian elements is mainly aimed at translating the spiritual perfection of the mystic into a system of political domination over the world, in a way that brings together a Neoplatonist philosophical system with a political theology that was cultivated in the theological rhetoric of Sasanian Zoroastrianism.